Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Help wanted. The city of Charlotte needs a new mayor, but if you want the job, you better hurry. Applications are due next week. Also on the horizon, a moratorium on data centers could be in place by Monday, pending a council vote. In Raleigh, State Representative Alan Chesser voices frustration with Mecklenburg County leaders over the death of Dominic Moody.
Failure to do your job.
Charlotte Fire Chief Reginald Johnson gets a big win on the budget.
Parity with police is our number one priority.
Councilman Malcolm Graham says a crackdown on car noise can't wait.
We must do something.
And how about those Hurricanes?
Gosta Spear, they score! Seth Jarvis quiets the critics!
Those stories and more are part of our local news roundup. This week's panel includes WFAE political reporter Steve Harrison. Ashley Fay is the managing editor from the Charlotte Ledger. WBTV investigative reporter David Hodges is with us, and Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome and good morning to you all.
Morning, Eric.
Morning.
Morning.
Okay, it's graduation season. Here's a job opening. You must be 21. You must be a registered Democrat. You must be a registered voter in Mecklenburg County, among other things. What else do we know about the process for replacing Vilals that started this week, Steve?
The I think, like you said, the applications open Monday, and initially the city said they weren't going to publish the list of people who applied, which was very strange. Joe Bruno at WSOC was kind of pushing them on this, and it took them a while to come around to the idea of putting out these names in public, but they finally did. Right now, 57 people have applied. I would say it's safe to say that they're not most of the names on the list just are not well known and are not going to be under consideration. I think there are two former elected officials. Former Mayor Jennifer Roberts has put in her name. Former city council member and Mecklenburg Commissioner Harold Cogdell has applied. We still haven't had yesterday's applications updated. So we've got Thursday, Friday, Monday, Tuesday. We've got a lot more time, but no one on the city council as of yet has applied, including James Mitchell, who said he wants the job. I think you'll see kind of a late rush on Tuesday from the important players. If they feel like they have a chance to be named, they're going to come in right under the radar, is my guess.
I want to ask the most important question, which is, I believe we have an applicant from Denmark. Is that correct?
That I am not sure, but yes, like I said, it's certainly possible.
So you mentioned Tuesday, June 9th is the deadline. The timetable that they're working on is to have a selection, I think, by June 22nd, and then have this person sworn in by July 1st. Of course, Mayor Lyles has said she would stay till June 30th or later if needed. David, my question for you, how likely is it that council gets this done on time?
It's certainly possible. It depends on all who applies, whether we get some of these applications coming from council members themselves. As has been rumored and talked about, a decent number of these council members probably want to run for mayor in the next election, and that could make it difficult to get the amount of votes necessary for someone. So maybe not. We'll see. But the entire process is mostly... some of it's going to be in public. We're going to have in-person candidate forums on June 15th. And like you said, should have that appointment by June 22nd.
Steve, what are you hearing from council members about James Mitchell in particular? He had sent that email with the outline of how he envisioned the role and promised not to run if he was appointed as interim mayor. What's the temperature right now on that?
Yeah, when that came out, I guess that was a week ago, I believe. Yeah, so in that kind of... that he sent that email to council over the weekend. And there seemed to be this momentum that, oh, James has the 6 votes, it's going to happen. And then it was kind of a not so fast that, well, maybe he doesn't have 6. And people, you know, they kind of, so I think Councilmember Mitchell is still working to try and get there and get those 6 votes. I mean, a big thing is that promise where he said, if I am named the next mayor, I will not run for mayor in 2027. that, of course, is a huge deal, as David said, to this council. And then Councilmember Mitchell, though, you know, had said, I mean, he's got a, he had told the Black Political Caucus on the Interstate 77 toll lanes, I will definitely vote to rescind this. And then the vote to rescind came up and he had to apologize and says, I can't do this. So, you know, he has flip-flopped pretty recently. And I think that's going to be on a lot of council members' minds, you know, whether he'll keep his word on not running.
How much do you think the baggage of him having to step down a couple of years ago factors into this, as well as if he was appointed or anyone who's on council is appointed, then you have to fill the council position?
You know, it's interesting that the baggage you talked about was when he went to work for Leaper Construction and then had to step down because he had a 25% ownership stake and the company couldn't do business with the city, something that no one apparently realized. You know, it's weird. I that was 6 years ago. The drama played out, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. There are new members on, excuse me, there's new members on the council. I'm not really sure that's top of mind. I think everyone is focused on 2027 and not looking back. You know, Councilmember Mitchell's big assets are he is well-liked. He is known as someone who can get six votes to get things passed. But yeah, I don't know. I think a lot of time has passed. For you and I, Eric, it seems like yesterday, but I think for a lot of people, it's ancient history.
The one thing I would point out, though, is a lot of things that seem like yesterday when you're a council member all of a sudden get the harsh spotlight when you become mayor. So while right now nobody's thinking about it, I think some of what I'm hearing is, oh, these things will be thought about again in more detail with a little bit more attention if he were to put his name in the hat and try and seek this appointment. So not something we think about now, could be something that's thought about a lot if he does seek this position.
I'm going to pretend that there's not fierce jockeying that's already been going on for months and months and months for the 2027 campaign. So I'll frame the question this way. Does the 2027 mayoral campaign begin the day that the selection is made for interim mayor?
I think it began the day that Vi Lyles announced that she was planning on resigning. So, it's already started, Eric.
So this really will not interrupt anything. It's just a formality. The okay. Go ahead, Ashley.
No. I was just saying it is exactly to David's point. You know, I think even what we've seen with the rescission, you know, what we've seen with Black Political Caucus, you know, all of this is in pursuit of that mayoral position next year, and whatever happens with the appointment, I think is going to set up for that for sure. But yeah, please proceed.
That's the voice of Ashley Fay from the Charlotte Ledger. Mary Ramsey is here from the Charlotte Observer. David Hodges from WBTV and WFAE's Steve Harrison. Steve, I want to ask you about a little pay raise that the interim mayor is likely to receive. I think that council is going to consider that on Monday as part of the budget vote. Vi Lyles earns $50,000 a year roughly right now. The salary would go up by 15% to $57,000 per year, including expenses. Total compensation could go up 10% to $80,000 a year. That's for the mayor. And council members could see a 6.4% overall increase to $68,000, also including expenses. So with all of that math in mind, Steve, it seems like this increase is not of much interest to voters or the public. Why not?
It's a good question. I mean, the Mecklenburg commissioners did this a couple years ago and gave themselves a pretty hefty pay raise. And, you know, they went first. There wasn't a lot of blowback, and now it's the city's turn. I think it's kind of a philosophical debate. I mean, there was this old school idea of public service as, you know, you have made your money elsewhere. You have a job. This is a very part-time position. And you know, there's a sense that in a way that's exclusionary, right? Because it does take a lot of time to serve. And there are people who haven't made enough money to do this. And this in a way kind of opens it up to a broad spectrum of the community to be elected officials. But then of course the counter argument to that is when you start, you know, when the pay goes up to 65,000, it becomes a job, something you can do just kind of for a long, long time. And maybe that wasn't the original intent of part-time public service.
On Monday, Deputy City Manager Allison Craig explained how a moratorium on data centers will work.
Anything that submits a full set of construction plans before a moratorium went into effect would be exempt. Anything that, once that moratorium goes into place, we will not be accepting any more applications.
Ashley, remind us where we're going with this idea of a moratorium on data centers and what it entails.
Yeah, so council is expected to vote on this on Monday. I would say it's probably going to pass. It's 150 days, a pause to allow the city to develop regulations around data centers. This has become highly controversial with a lot of community groups, especially in East Charlotte, as there's a data center proposed in East Charlotte. It's been going through rezoning. It is only 40,000 square feet, but I think a lot of the concern is around the hyperscale data centers that are 1 million square feet plus. To Deputy City Manager Allison Craig's point, there are already two hyperscale data centers that have already been approved, so they will not actually qualify under this moratorium. They can proceed as planned because they were approved before the moratorium, if it does pass, goes into effect. But I think an important note here, Eric, is that there, a lot of this might be determined by the state. There's a couple of bills currently going through the state right now that would either regulate data centers, these large hyperscale data centers, or give local governments like Charlotte more authority about how they can regulate data centers. Right now, the city has very limited sort of leverage on that. And I think the moratorium is almost a way to buy time for the state to kind of change some of the policy around that.
What are you hearing, if anything, about this idea of, I think they call it downscaling on the land use and the city being prohibited by existing state law? And Allison Craig and other city officials have said, yes, this is a concern, but they have not given a definitive answer. Is that a lot of what the next 5 months would be about?
Exactly, Eric. Yes, it's the downzoning measure. I think it's state
I'm sorry, bill. I said downscaling, downzoning. Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Yes, it's the state bill that passed in late 2024. It's kind of wrapped into a bill around Hurricane Helene relief funding. But basically, it severely strips the ability of local governments to downzone properties. You'd have to get the written consent of all affected property owners, which is just something that's not super viable. This just doesn't give a lot of leverage as far as what the city of Charlotte can do around really a lot of land use types, especially because the city of Charlotte just went through the big UDO, the comp plan, and all of that. So I think there's a bill currently right now, being considered that would give local governments that authority back in some capacity. That's separate from the data center bill, which is State Bill 730, mm-hmm. Which is being fast-tracked right now through the legislature, which would give governments the ability to regulate data centers a little bit more than they can today.
Dimple Ashmira is one of the leading proponents of this. I believe she proposed this, but there are others. J.D. Mazuera Arias, Luana Mayfield was early on this topic. We think we know that half the council wants to run for mayor. Is this much of a differentiating issue for the mayor's race, you think?
Yeah, I think, that may have been one of the motivators for Councilmember Dimple Ashmira to kind of get in front of this and call for a moratorium specifically around residential neighborhoods. That's been her big thing. We need to regulate data centers around neighborhoods and things like that. But yes, I think it's another example, Eric, of how the council is kind of addressing some of these flashpoint issues. The development community certainly has been speaking out against the moratorium. And I think it's just another example of some of the energy we've been seeing on council lately.
I think developers sometimes are involved in funding campaigns as well. I'm not sure about that, but we'll see. We need to take a break. When we return, a tense hearing in Raleigh as state lawmakers ask hard questions about the death of 6-year-old Dominic Moody in December. This is Charlotte Talks. Stay with us. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and this is the local news roundup with Ashley Fay of the Charlotte Ledger, Steve Harrison from WFAE, WBTV's David Hodges, and Mary Ramsey from the Charlotte Observer. Mary, you were in Raleigh on Thursday as county leaders testified before the House Oversight Committee about the traumatic life and death of 6-year-old Charlotte girl Dominique Moody. They heard from the sheriff, the police chief, social services, and other authorities. What differences and similarities stood out to you from their testimony?
Yeah, so I think one of the biggest things to come out of this was County Manager Mike Bryant revealing that 12 county employees faced some sort of discipline over Moody's death. One was terminated, one resigned, 10 others were disciplined. That was new information. And there were also a lot of questions from the committee about what they said were some inconsistencies between what the county had said previously about the situation versus some of the testimony they offered yesterday, as well as what they said were some discrepancies between the state Department of Health and Human Services report on this case versus what the county was saying. So a lot of questions still about how exactly this six-year-old girl ended up dead in East Charlotte.
Cabarrus County Representative Brian Echevarria said that the circumstances surrounding her death were even worse than those of the events surrounding Arena Zarutska last summer when she was fatally stabbed on a Cats light rail train.
I've sat here for most of the day just listening, and this is the most upsetting hearing we've had. And that's hard because we also had Irena here, that hearing.
So, Mary, as unspeakable as all of this is, it's worth reminding everyone of the circumstances that prompted this hearing. How did we get here?
Yes. So Dominique Moody, as you said, was a six-year-old girl. She was found dead in December at her aunt's home in East Charlotte. The aunt had been granted custody of Dominique and her sister, who had grown up in Cumberland County. And according to court records and the coroner's report, Moody weighed just 27 pounds when she died. Her body showed signs of abuse and malnourishment. According to court records, she was kept in a dog crate. She was not enrolled in school as a six-year-old girl. So just a lot of really, as you said, just unspeakable, gruesome details discussed yesterday and in court records about what happened to this little girl.
And you and others have reported on the numerous calls for investigation, reports, and really none of it led to anything. What did we hear from the county as to why nothing happened?
Yes, so there were 12 calls in the last 5 or so years to Mecklenburg County. CMPD also had been at the home multiple times, but ultimately the children were not removed. And that was one of the big questions yesterday. How did social workers and officers go to this home, which according to public record was dilapidated, and not see that there was an issue with these children that need to be followed up with? The county has said they are working to address these issues. They have been placed on a corrective action plan by the State Department of Health and Human Services, who sent a letter in late May to the county saying that after reviewing Moody's case file and because of the issues they found there, about 100 other social services cases, they found some, quote, broad systemic issues. So we're still, the county's message back has sort of been, you know, we're taking initiative to address these issues proactively. But I think one of the biggest points of contention in yesterday's hearing was how nothing was done in this specific case. At one point, Representative Alan Chesser, who's been sort of beating the drum on this case in Raleigh, seemed to imply that at some point, someone in Mecklenburg County Social Services had presented the option of removing the children from the home and that a supervisor did not follow through on that. He then walked that back and said that a supervisor had altered a social service employee's description of an injury to Dominique Moody that had been reported before her death. The county said they have no record of any dispute within social services about what to do about her. But again, just a lot of questions about how this happened. As I mentioned, 12 employees were disciplined. Mike Bryant said that was the result of an HR investigation that he launched after Moody's death alongside a broader internal investigation of social services. So we'll see what the county tells the state as they put together this corrective action plan, they have 30 days, so till about the end of June, to get that submitted to the state. The state will then have to approve it, and the county will have to keep coming back to show they're making progress. If they don't make satisfactory progress, then the state could potentially take over some oversight of Mecklenburg's Social Services Department.
One thing that Representative Echevarria made clear is that he does not believe this is a staffing issue.
Now, I get it. Some caseloads are heavy, but these are severe. They were asked earlier. You don't have that many cases with 13 different reports. Of course, this should have gotten the attention necessary. And no, staffing will not fix it because staff looked at it. It wasn't that someone didn't get to it. They got to it, and they dismissed it.
Mary, was that the prevailing view on the committee?
That did come up multiple times, yes. So the county has been emphasizing that their new budget, which takes effect July 1st, includes a large infusion of money into social services, including funding for new employees. And the committee also heard yesterday from a subject matter expert, a social work professor and researcher at UNC Chapel Hill. And she said that while more staffing can certainly be good, especially with growing number of cases and a growing number of complex cases, that what's really needed is better education and training, and also looking at how new technologies can be used to detect red flags within cases, and potentially could have caught the red flags in Dominique Moody's case before she perished.
Deputy County Manager Kim Campbell told Representative Alan Chesser, you mentioned earlier, leading this committee, that she agrees someone should be held accountable.
I believe that people should be held accountable. We don't get to always determine what the consequences are for another's actions, but I do believe that, you know, in our roles, we should hold people accountable to the greatest extent that we can, right? Understanding that we don't have all the cards for all the situations and partners to help us with that accountability. And I think that that also applies to keeping kids safe, not just accountability and consequences, but to the very act of keeping kids safe.
Mary, you mentioned that the county manager, Mike Bryant, told the committee about discipline and firings related to this. When I hear Kim Campbell's remarks there, it sounds like accountability, yes, also sounds like some hedging. What did you hear in that?
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. You know, we did find out yesterday that one person was fired, one person resigned, 10 others were disciplined, but the committee seemed eager to see more, going so far at times to imply that people within the county could face some sort of criminal charges, pointing out that there are state statutes on the book about mandated reporting with regard to child abuse, about how much information child services has to pass on to the district attorney if they see something that potentially rises to the level of a criminal case. So whether anything like that actually comes to fruition remains to be seen. Obviously, that would be quite a dramatic step in this case, but it was something that was floated yesterday by multiple members of the committee.
That's the voice of Mary Ramsey. She's with the Charlotte Observer. Also with us is Ashley Fay, David Hodges, and Steve Harrison. On a related note, Mary, you just mentioned the new positions are 22 new positions for child, family, and adult services that are part of the budget that Mecklenburg County commissioners approved this week. It's a $2.6 billion budget for the fiscal year that begins July 1st, and it includes a minimum wage for full-time employees increasing to $25.53 per hour, a livable wage, plus a 3% across-the-board pay raise for county employees, and no property tax increase. And speaking of budgets, Charlotte Fire Chief Reginald Johnson said this week that he appreciates City Council making a change in the budget's planned pay raises for firefighters.
Pay parity with police is our number one priority, and I'm very thankful to City Council for their vote to keep us with pay parity with police.
Ashley, what did council do and why did they do it?
Yeah, there was some debate about what exactly to do to get to pay parity. Do we reduce what the police officers, CMPD, was proposed? So they're proposed to get a 10% pay raise. There was some debate about, you know, where does this money come from if we try to achieve pay parity between firefighters and police officers? Ultimately, the council members agreed to raise what had been proposed at 7% pay raises for Charlotte Fire to 10% to match CMPD's. That is a $4.4 million gap in funding. So that's probably going to come out of, you know, the proposed police fire technology upgrades. I think there's a couple million that'll come from that. Firefighters overtime budget, which it got brought up during the meeting that the fire department routinely goes over budget on that. So that's something that's probably going to have to be figured out. And then eliminating three new planned field technician jobs for fire. But it seemed to be a priority of council to keep that pay parity between police officers and fire.
And again, the vote is Monday, so that takes effect July 1st, assuming the budget passes. Correct?
That's correct.
And if the budget doesn't pass, we're going to have a really long show next week. Also from City Council, on Monday, Council Committee backed a proposed ban on street vending. It still needs full council approval, but James Mitchell has some concerns.
I'm struggling with the word criminal when I think most of our street vendors have good intention to try to be successful and grow their business. So,
Councilman Ed Driggs supports penalties for vendors who repeatedly ignore the rules.
We would need to help them, guide them through the process, show them the way to do it properly, but then have deterrence for those who are scofflaws and just stick their tongue out when you tell them to move.
All right, David, address the scofflaws and where we're going with this one.
Yeah, so right now, street vending carries essentially like a citation, a fine, if there's a violation of it. But City Council learned that a lot of these fines essentially are not being paid. So the City Council Committee did vote in favor of continuing to look into the possibility of a criminal.
Speaking of hedging, go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, even Councilman Mitchell, I believe, ended up voting in favor of continuing to look into this just because there's limited ways that I think they're finding out to enforce street vending that's being done in violation of the city ordinances. There was a pilot program that allowed people to do this in NOTA that expired. They're looking at essentially just banning this across the city except for some different entertainment districts like in Uptown and South End. So it's a difficult issue for council to kind of wrap their hands around because they don't necessarily want to criminalize small business entrepreneurs who are just trying to make a living. But there's also a lot of complaints from the brick and mortar stores about how they're operating and what's being sold.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask you. Are there a lot of complaints? Sounds like there are.
Yeah. There's definitely complaints about this from both the businesses, the people who visit these districts, people saying that the street vendors are in the way. Or aggressive. It's a safety issue, but then also impacting the businesses that are trying to sell food there. So it's an issue that council keeps bringing up. So they must be getting some complaints about it.
And if it's not street vendors, it's loud cars. Malcolm Graham is among the council members who say they are being inundated with complaints about cars that have modified exhaust systems.
Guests who are complaining at night about loud noise, 1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. And so it's not a question of if we have to do something. We must do something.
All right, David, let's rerun this. We did street vendors. What are we doing about loud cars?
Well, the city is looking at the possibility of what's called noise cameras, essentially. And these
that
these
seems counterintuitive ones... to me.
Yeah, how smart do I sound when I say noise cameras? Those two senses don't jive. But essentially, this would be a way to monitor noise violations from these types of altered mufflers, vehicles across the city. However, CMPD attorney Jessica Battle says that because North Carolina is a Dillon rule state, meaning the state legislature sets the rules for the towns that they're supposed to follow, the city is not currently legally allowed to install these types of cameras for enforcement purposes. So it would be really expensive to set up these types of devices to monitor noise, to not even be able to enforce, get fines, violations, citations. So they're talking about the possibility of getting someone in the state legislature to sponsor a bill to allow these types of devices, There's an incredible amount of complaints about this almost no matter where you live in Charlotte, but especially uptown. I believe a CMPD captain said that it's the number one complaint they receive is complaints about noise violations regarding these types of vehicles.
Based on what you just said, though, it sounds like it's going to take a while before these pieces can be put in place to take action.
Yeah, if you're going to get a state lawmaker to sponsor a bill and try, I mean, that on the time for that is honestly passed for this year. So good job, I say somewhat ironically, the city council getting on top of this ahead of time. You know, CMPD did have an enforcement date a while back, trying to kind of set the tone on these types of violations. But it is something that's pretty difficult for local police to enforce en masse. I mean, whether you live all the way in South, anywhere around 485 or uptown, you're aware of this issue. So it's going to take some time to fully address.
Much more immediate, it seems, Steve, is a request for $23 million for something called the World Military Games, which is an Olympic-style competition that is set to bring 10,000 soldier athletes to the region next year. This one popped up as part of the Economic Development Committee at Council this week. Take us inside how this bubbled up and what the reaction was.
Yeah, so the World Military Games, they've had, this would be the eighth version of them, the first in the United States. The last time they were held was in Wuhan, actually, Wuhan, China, in 2019, right before the pandemic, and then COVID kind of put everything on pause, so they're trying to bring it back. It is supposed to take place in late June and run through July for about 2 weeks in 2027. The City Council's Economic Development Committee was going through just kind of a general presentation on hospitality taxes. And they had a slide up that said, you know, funding requests, World Military Games. And Ashley, I think we were talking before the show that you had said the city didn't mention the number and someone had to ask.
That's right.
And then when they, you know, the city said, well, $23 million. And I think that's cash and in-kind, you know, contributions. There was kind of a couple of council members who groaned, you know, that was a big, big number.
And so I assume this goes onto the scroll, the long list of things looking for funding, but we don't have a decision coming at least imminently.
Yeah, I mean, apparently the founders of the games or the local organizing committee is negotiating with the city. But it's interesting, you know, at this point, if the games happen, they are a little over a year away. They haven't released a list of venues or anything. So it'll be curious to see what happens.
And it'll be curious to see what's coming next. Stay with us on Charlotte Talks. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. This is the local news roundup with Ashley Fay, Mary Ramsey, David Hodges, and Steve Harrison. We're just going affiliation free. Okay. Charlotte Ledger, Charlotte Observer, WBTV, WFAE. There will be a quiz at the end of this. Steve, this has happened a couple of times of late here and elsewhere in the state, and this being the issue of how tourism taxes are spent. They are designated to go to tourism, duh, but there's been a lot of talk about using them for other things because it's an abundant source of revenue. It happened again this week when Councilman J.D. Mesuera-Arias mentioned using some tourism tax revenue for public safety.
We owe it to the residents of Charlotte and all Charlottians for us to see how we can further make our streets safer using any available funding and tax dollars at the disposal of council.
And those comments sparked a quick response in Raleigh, including this from Representative Julia Howard.
And it seems that a couple of counties have started to want to use the occupancy tax for the general expenses in their county.
All right, Steve, let's unwind this. Again, trying to take tourism tax revenue and use it for other things. It's been a topic a couple of times. Now it sounds like Raleigh is getting interested in maybe putting a more forceful demarcation down. What do you think is going to happen next with this one?
Yeah, so it goes back, really. There's been discussion in Mecklenburg County about this, but really the key focal point where this took place was in Currituck County on the beach. Currituck County had used has been using some of their hotel motel taxes for public safety. And their rationale was that we're a beach town. We get a lot of tourists. We need to keep them safe. So there was a lawsuit in Currituck, and the North Carolina State Supreme Court, which has a 5-2 conservative majority, sided with Currituck County and said this could happen. And then that prompted Councilmember Arias to say, well, maybe we should look at doing the same thing in Charlotte. The legislature has moved very, very quickly to shut this down completely. The House overwhelmingly passed a bill that would prohibit this. It will likely go to the Senate next week. It will be passed. I think almost every Mecklenburg State House member except Jordan Lopez voted in favor of this, which I thought was a bit surprising given this being a Democratic city and there being this like kind of like, you know, this idea of like a way to raise more revenue. But it was a slam dunk at the state level to put a stop to this.
Now, what you mentioned just now is really interesting, and that is we have a clearly Republican Supreme Court majority. Is there any appetite out there, you think, to perhaps challenge new legislation passed by the Republican majority legislature by going to the Republican majority Supreme Court that just said, no, you can do this?
You know, I think that, you know, if there is a state statute that says you can't, I assume then the same court would have ruled that, well, state law says this is prohibited and it's over, you know, that they had ruled kind of on a gray area when it wasn't said that they felt like it was appropriate. But yeah, just the quickness that this has been ended is really fascinating, how fast this you know, the wheels of government turned on this. And, you know, from the other side, the hotel industry, I talked to Vinay Patel about this. He owns a lot of hotels in Charlotte. And he says, look, I already pay property taxes on my hotels. That money should pay for police. I'm agreeing to tax myself more to bring in events, to give myself more business. But don't tax me twice, is what he's saying for the same thing.
And it's important to note that some of the most prominent projects in the city are coming from that tax, including an upcoming $800 million renovation of Bank of America Stadium. And Steve, going back to the World Military Games presentation that you and Ashley saw this week, at least every briefing I hear says that that money is tight, not abundant, and not available to be spread across other services. So I guess there's even a division within city government.
Yeah, and this request with World Military Games, it will be interesting how this plays out, because I can't think, and Eric, maybe you can think of something, I can't think of a request, you know, $23 million for a single event, like a standalone. I can't think of anything that comes close to that. You know, the DNC was paid for by private money and a federal security grant. I mean, the DNC involved a lot more money, but it was paid for by other people. $23 million for a two-week period, that's a lot of money. And it'll be interesting to see. The hospitality industry usually kind of gives council the, like, kind of look like, we want this, we are okay with this, and council usually follows. So it'll be curious to see how all of the different players, what they decide to do with this going forward.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, the major NBA All-Star Game and other things like that, it's usually in the realm of a couple million dollars. Switching gears, David, on Monday, the U.S. Department of Education disclosed that a Title IX investigation is underway in Cabarrus County to look into accusations that the school system has ignored reports by female students of mistreatment. What is this about, and what is the school system saying?
Yeah, so the U.S. Department of Education is alleging that multiple female students within the district have reported being required to dress or undress in the presence of males, kind of locker room, bathroom areas. This all started with a video, essentially, that was put out by a conservative-leaning organization, Cabarrus County, in which female students were talking about one of their friends who essentially was in this situation. Some of those students and parents then also spoke at a school board meeting. This got on the radar of Congressman Addison McDowell. And once that happened, he put in a request for the Department of Education to conduct this investigation. And once you have a congressman doing that, it's going to be happening. Cabarrus County Schools, they did issue a statement. They didn't say a whole lot. They said that they remain committed to providing safe, respectful, and legally compliant learning environment for all students, but they say they really can't comment much beyond that while this investigation is pending.
And do we know how long it's been going?
So the investigation just started in Monday. There was a similar report about something like this in 2024 that went viral, and the district officials said they investigated it back then and found that there was essentially no truth to this situation. So it'll be interesting to see what the Title IX investigation finds, whether it goes back to that incident or if there's new incidents. We'll have to just wait and see.
Ashley, we learned this week through newly released tax statistics from the county that the Border Patrol surge last November, ordered by the Trump administration, cost businesses in East Charlotte and on South Boulevard, where those patrols took place. What kind of hit did they absorb?
Yeah, and great reporting by Julian Berger at WFAE. But yeah, it looks like total tax collections fell about 10% in that time period, which maybe doesn't sound like a lot, but it really is, especially when you consider across Mecklenburg County, it was about 5%. So that's effectively double. I mean, I think we all remember back then, a lot of folks just closed businesses. People, even when they were open, workers didn't necessarily show up to work just because of fear of enforcement and raids and things of that nature. And I think this ties into a broader story. I know Brookings Institution, they just did a study around the impact of law enforcement or immigration enforcement around the country. And certain sectors of the economy, especially construction and hospitality, are still kind of being impacted by this. I think there's a lot of ripple effects that maybe come of this. A lot of it is just workers just fearful for their jobs, fearful of showing up at job sites, not knowing if there'll be a raid.
And I think the Brookings report estimated that the raids cost the area something like 10,000 jobs for a lot of the reasons you just outlined, either fear of showing up or businesses diminished. And I guess my question for you there is, do you think that's a reasonable type of estimate?
I think so. And honestly, it might even be more because so much of this is, it's just so hard to know how many people are employed, especially in construction. We do know that between 20 to 40% of the workforce there, which is a very wide range, are potentially made up of undocumented immigrants. So it's just hard to know the true impact here. But from what we can track, I think construction employment or the construction levels, employment losses are 4%, down 4%, since some of this immigration enforcement started nationally. And this is an industry, especially construction, that is already very labor constrained. And when you're labor constrained, you don't have people coming into job sites. Sometimes those get shut down. Things just raise in price because then you have to raise your wages to get workers back on site. There's just a lot of ripple effects here. Hard to say exactly what it all means for Charlotte, but I do think it's substantial, and it's something we're probably still feeling even if the operation here is over.
Steve, given the sharp criticism of the ICE patrols here by U.S. Senator Tom Tillis and the lack of data, he was asking about arrests and how effective this was. Might we see a renewed push by Senator Tillis to obtain more information on the results of the campaign here?
Yeah, I think that's definitely could happen. He had asked in November, shortly after the raids in Congress for information on arrests and just exactly what transpired. And I think that those statistics on the lost tax revenue were going to, certainly an option to bring this up again and ask them to ask the overarching question of really what was accomplished here in Charlotte last year.
And I'm trying to remember, you remind me, when he made those comments, was he already sort of on the tour of "You Only Live Once, I'm Not Running Again"?
I mean, definitely he had already announced he wasn't running. And the tour, his statements and his on the tour keep getting more pronounced and bigger and bigger. But yes, he was definitely on the on that track already, is speaking truths. Or is he speaking truths?
I'm being a little glib, but politicians act a little differently sometimes when they're not running for re-election. Breaking news. Mary, speaking of breaking news, some good news for Mallard Creek High School after a controversial and apparently erroneous disqualification in the state track finals. Can we now call them champions?
We can, yes. So back a few weeks ago at the state track title, runner for Mallard Creek was the first to cross the finish line. As he did so, he raised a hand in celebration, knowing that by winning that event, he had secured his school enough points to take the title. And he was then disqualified for that. A referee decided that that hand motion was a violation of rules. That meant that Mallard Creek got no points for the event and did not win the title. But that decision has now been overturned by state officials, and Mallard Creek are officially co-state champions. The student said that he was raising his hand. He sort of like splayed out his fingers for a five to signify the fact that this would be Mallard Creek's fifth track title in recent years. The Observer, my colleague Scott Fowler, did a lot of great reporting on this, dug through some photos from the track meet and found that there were other students from other schools who made similar gestures as they were crossing the finish line in celebration and weren't disqualified. This triggered a lot of conversation on social media about, you know, kids these days and sportsmanship and all kinds of stuff, but ultimately a positive resolution for Mallard Creek, and congrats to them on another state title.
Finally, if you stayed up to watch the Carolina Hurricanes' thrilling comeback win last night, you may be feeling a little bleary-eyed, or maybe you just saw Republican Senate candidate Michael Whatley's AI-generated social media tribute to the NHL team earlier this week. Brian Anderson, a reporter at the Assembly, tried to ask Whatley about his Caniac credentials, but he didn't get very far.
I saw you post about the Carolina Hurricanes.
Yep.
Who are your three favorite Hurricanes players?
You know, I think we like them all.
Don't have a favorite player?
Look, I think that that's a team that's loaded. They're playing offense really well. I'm excited about having them.
And what about the graphic that was created yesterday? How'd that come about?
And it's just a graphic that we created.
You use AI for the graphic.
Yeah,
was that intentional? And can you talk about that as far as like the Canes and, you know, using their name or whatever, if there's any kind of issue there?
Well, look, I want to see the Carolina Hurricanes win. I think it's absolutely great for the state, and I think it's fun that they're in the Stanley Cup Finals, and you know, we did use AI for it.
Last chance, can you name
Thanks,
one
guys.
Hurricane
Appreciate
player?
Thanks, guys. Thanks, guys.
Steve, it sounds like a player to be named later. So do we have a Cal Cunningham moment on our hands, given Roy Cooper has pretty sterling Canes credentials?
Yeah, we do, in a way. It's interesting because I feel like in politics, it's Democratic candidates who are often fumble things like this and seen as a bit out of touch. And, you know, how they eat their food, or like you said, Cal Cunningham's barbecue. And it was, in a way, I feel for Whatley. I mean, I personally do not follow the NHL, and it's not the NFL. And I could see how he's just not aware, and he's not able in the moment quick enough to say, hey, look, I'm just not a super fan. I you know, I'm pulling for the team. But I do think it's interesting how it kind of shows sometimes in political campaigns, things just break for you or against you. And Michael Whatley has been struggling all campaign to try and close this gap with Roy Cooper, and he's still 8 or 9 or 10 points down in the polls.
As for the main thing, Carolina beat the Golden Knights 4-3, tying the best of seven series at one game apiece. Forward Seth Jarvis scored the winning goal.
Yeah, this is exciting. This is what playoff hockey is all about: is tight games and momentum swings, and you never really know what's going to happen next. So I don't think you can ask any more of a playoff series.
So now we go to Game 3, which is Saturday in Las Vegas. This gives Michael Whatley a chance to create new social media posts. Maybe Roy Cooper would like to create some as well. Do we have, very quickly, predictions? Canes, will they do it? Ashley Faye, begin.
I'm the expert. Obviously, yes.
Mary?
Canes in 6.
Wow. David Hodges?
As I said last week, my prediction tracker on the show is pretty poor, so I want to stay out of it so I do not jinx the Canes.
Oh, wow. What a noble man you are. Chivalry isn't dead. Steve Harrison.
Yeah, I'll go with Ashley and Mary just because that's the easiest thing to say.
There we go. That's the last word. Ashley Faye, David Hodges, Mary Ramsey, Steve Harrison, thank you all for being here on the Local News Roundup. For Mike Collins, I'm Eric Spanberg. Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.